T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
And welcome back to Overnight America. Here we are. Kind of an exciting time, isn't it? We're going to wait and see. Wednesday is the big day. Wednesday. Are you excited for that? I'm actually super excited to see what the Cardinals can do. A 4:02 first pitch is what we're expecting here in St. Louis, Missouri. And if we actually get to that point where Wednesday night, if there's a win, we know there's going to be a lot of celebrating going on, and we're going to be on right after the post game. So we're going to have a lot to celebrate, lots to celebrate. All right, so Overnight America continues, and tomorrow the big announcement is that, yes, we are going to be broadcasting starting at 8 o'clock from here on out. Woo, so exciting. I'm looking forward to it, and I hope you can join me tomorrow for our first show, the 8 o'clock show. I got a lot planned for you tomorrow. We have a couple of live guests that we're going to do, and that's what I really like. The idea of doing these interviews live, which gives you the opportunity to text in questions while we're talking to our guest. And who knows, maybe we can even bring you up to our guest if you wanted to call in and ask a question to him too, which actually works pretty well. Our friend Rich Rubino is going to join us in a moment. He has a book called American Politics on the Rocks. I wanted to talk to him about the field of Democrats right now. When are they going to dwindle down? Are there going to be any late names in the game? Like, people are still talking about Hillary, for example. And I wanted to go back into the history of the leading contender of the opposition party, of whoever's sitting in the White House at the time. And in this case, it's Joe Biden. And there's a lot of questions about investigating Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden, some of the activities that happened while he was vice president. Is that something that's happened in the past, as the whoever was leading the polls of the opposition party had an open investigation against them? And Rich had some pretty good, interesting insights into that. I saw a story, and the Daily Mail posted this, but a couple of other places posted it as well. And there was a viral video that started to surface about an interview with Joe Rogan. And if you don't know who Joe Rogan is, Joe Rogan is, let me see if I can bring this up real quick. He's a podcaster. He is someone that has a very popular podcast, one of the most listened to, if not the most listened to. And he brings on some really interesting guests. He loves conspiracy, alien talk, things like that. And there was one was Commander David Fravor. And he had an account of a UFO encounter that happened about 10 years earlier. But he's also someone that talks about encounters with video surveillance, things that have been recorded, now declassified, released. And the fascinating thing about this is he talked about how there was this dark mass that emerged from the ocean that swallowed up a torpedo. What an interesting thing to see. Here, I'm going to see if I can play this real quick. I think this is it. Yeah, I think this is it. I tried to record it, but it looks like I recorded the wrong part, but this is from the Joe Rogan podcast, given the experience.
He says he's sitting in the front, you know, in helicopters, there's, you know, CH-53, you can actually see down by your feet, you know, just like typical, like you go to Hawaii and ride, because you can see when you're touching down. So you got really good visibility out of those things, and you can stick your head out the window, too, because you're just kind of hanging out. He says he's going on there, and they're getting this thing hooked up, and as he's looking down, you know, because they're, I don't know what, 50 feet above the water, he sees kind of this dark mass coming up from the depths. And they start to hoist the diver up, and they've got the BQM, and as they hoist it up, he says, and he's looking at this thing going, what the hell is that? And then it just goes back down underwater. It just, like, once they pull the kid and the BQM out of the water, this object descends back into the depths. So he thinks, well, that was pretty weird. So he goes out, he says, not too long later, you know, a few months later, he's out and he's picking up a torpedo. So he says they hooked the diver up on the winch and they're lowering him in. And as he's looking down, he sees this big, massive, he goes, it's not a submarine. He's seen submarines before. Once you see a submarine, you can't confuse it with something else. This big object, you know, kind of circular, he says, is coming up from the depths. And he starts screaming through the intercom system to tell him to pull the diver up. And the diver's like a few feet from the water. So they reverse the winch, and the diver's thinking, what the hell's going on? And he's getting pulled up, and all of a sudden, he said the torpedo just got sucked down underwater.
Whoa.
And the object just descended back down into the depths.
Whoa. Okay, so that's some... This may be third-party accounts, but still, he goes on, and I didn't listen to the entire podcast. It's like over an hour long, this interview. And if you wanted to look it up for yourself, Commander David Fravor, he's wearing a Detroit Tigers shirt, which is actually pretty cool. So he's given his accounts, and this happened in the 1990s. So if you go back about 10 years or so, he gives these accounts of UFOs and different people that have seen things, ranking military officials that have put out memos about, you know, seeing these things and some of these unidentified things. But this happened in Puerto Rico 10 years earlier than that in the 1990s. Doesn't have an exact date on it. But someone, there's a mass that sucked in a torpedo? What? Now, that's a new one for me. I've heard a lot of UFO conspiracy stories, but you got me wondering what's down there in the water now, how accurate something like that is. So you hear these accounts every once in a while. I might have to bring on our friend over in Vancouver who does Spaced Out Radio. Dave does an excellent job, and he's the one that can tell me about some of these different encounters that people have seen. But there's a different twist to it when it's military involved. And the reason why there's a different twist is because it's documented. So if you get these pilots that work for the military, they have to debrief. They report these things, and there's a paper trail of things that they witnessed. In some cases, there's even videos of them recording certain instruments that they use will record heat samples, for example. It might not be something that is a actual camera, but it'll be like a heat sensor camera, so you can see things at a much further distance. So if someone's flying and they catch something in the distance, you might be able to catch a certain pattern, and then you realize it's different than a bird, you know, or a large hawk or something like that versus something that they don't know that's far off in the distance. And they use these different heat patterns to try to determine that. Some of these videos have been released, and the United States government has looked into UFOs in the past. Now, they haven't come to a conclusion by any means, but they have started to release more information on it. And he's someone that's been very open and vocal about the analysis of these things. So it's fascinating. I like to see that. But what I'm mentioning here, and same thing with the thing that sucked a torpedo in for the water, you know you're going to want to go online and check that out immediately. That's the first thing I did when I saw that headline. Just one other thing to wonder about on this planet. All right, our friend Rich Rubino, American Politics on the Rocks. We're going to talk to him about the current election, what's going on. Maybe give a couple of historical references up next on Overnight America KMOX. His book is called American Politics on the Rocks, which you can find on Amazon. You can look him up online as well. Our guest on Monday nights, Rich Rubino. Thanks for coming on to Overnight America.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, actually, starting next week, we announced that there's going to be a different time for Overnight America. We're starting at 8 p.m., which means we're going to do these interviews at a different time Monday night, which is pretty exciting. So I'm really looking forward to having you on earlier, which will be really cool. So let me talk to you about a few things that are going on in the Democrat Party as the primaries are still in full swing. I see a lot of articles and people sharing things on social media. One of the things that fascinate me about Joe Biden is that if it was any other candidate with that much pressure on them, I feel like they would have probably have ducked out by now. But it seems like Joe Biden has a lot of support. And I was curious where you see a lot of his support coming from that keeps him fueling and keeps them up there in the polls and going forward in the race.
You know, it's interesting because so the Democratic Party, they're basically kind of two bloodlines. This always happens in a Democratic race. There's always the person who appeals to kind of the white intellectuals, if you will, people that are kind of upscale, sometimes have college educations, live in the suburbs. And then there's the more, I guess, moderate and conservative Democrats. Sometimes they're usually very, very pro-labor. They kind of try to disassociate themselves from social issues sometimes. They tend to appeal to working-class voters, mm-hmm. to African-Americans, and to older voters. And in this race, what you see is Elizabeth Warren and Bernie, to a certain degree, Bernie Sanders, but they're appealing to the younger voters. And Joe Biden's appealing to older voters, African-American voters, specifically older African-American voters, as well as members of unions. For example, the firefighters came out very early in the race and endorsing him. And, I mean, you see this in almost every election. Go back, for example, to 68, the two coalitions, the union folks, the older voters, and a lot of the African-Americans like Hubert Humphrey, mm-hmm. Eugene McCarthy, his opponent, had support of a lot of the younger voters, the folks with higher degrees, for example, and generally in higher income brackets. In 72, you had George McGovern running, and he was a 200-to-1 long shot at the beginning. He ended up garnering the nomination with the support of younger voters, whereas Hubert Humphrey ran again that year. Ed Muskie ran again that year, who was a senator from Maine, garnered a lot of the support from kind of the more labor unions, the working class voters, the African Americans. Then in 76, what happened is Jimmy Carter ran. And Jimmy Carter, former governor, one-term governor of Georgia, runs in 1976. And he gets a lot of support, actually, from the African-American community specifically. And that's part of what gave him the nomination. He had the support from the King family, for example. Martin Luther King Jr.'s father, for example, was a huge supporter of him. And the fact that he was a Southern governor, he was more conservative than pretty much almost any candidate, except maybe Alabama Governor George Wallace. But African Americans tend to be a little bit more conservative than the rest of the Democratic Party, and also a little more religious, a little more evangelical. Actually, their religious convictions are very similar to white evangelicals. Their politics is a little bit different. And Jimmy Carter appealed to that constituency. He appealed to some conservative Southerners because he was a Southern governor, and he appealed to African Americans as well. And just keep going. You know, in 1984 and 88, Jesse Jackson garnered a lot of the African American support. But in 1992, Bill Clinton, the Southern governor again, garnered 70% of the African American support in that election cycle, and he also got a lot of labor union supporters, whereas a lot of the kind of younger voters were going with candidates like Paul Tsongas or Jerry Brown in that race. And it's interesting because there was actually an incident when Bill Clinton was campaigning in New Hampshire that year, and there was a fellow named Ricky Ray Rector.
Mm-hmm.
And Ricky Ray Rector had killed somebody, and while he was killing him, he essentially injured himself, and he got to the point where he was very low functioning. And Clinton actually went back to Arkansas to proceed over that execution.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a huge issue, and some African Americans protested him. Ricky Rector was African American, but Clinton still won the support of the African American vote. So those are some examples of kind of where Joe Biden's constituency is right now. It's kind of the old Democratic coalition, if you will.
Wow, that's interesting. It seems like a lot of the strategies have changed for the other candidates because each of them try to carve out different demographics. Do they feel like Joe Biden has that locked in, or do you see a lot of the other candidates trying to put up competition for that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think Elizabeth Warren specifically is trying to do that. Part of Elizabeth Warren's problem is the image that she has, that she's a professor at Harvard from Cambridge. And some people would rather kind of almost would portray her as somebody who's almost born at Cambridge or born at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
But Elizabeth Warren, I think she actually, it's interesting, when she was campaigning in 2014 and 2016, she was campaigning in the midterm elections. And she was invited to places like West Virginia and Kentucky to campaign for candidates like Amy McGrath, who was running against Andy Barr in Kentucky, for example, because her message, although her message appeals to the working class voters specifically on issues like trade, for example. Joe Biden supported NAFTA. Joe Biden supported bringing China into the World Trade Organization. He supported some of President Obama's deals with South Korea, for example,
mm-hmm.
trade deals. He supported some trade deals in the Bush administration. Elizabeth Warren has always been kind of an economic nationalist, opposed to almost every trade deal.
Mm-hmm.
And she predicates her entire campaign on the fact that the middle-class families are getting what she would call a raw deal. She would say that the middle class is getting hammered. Her challenge is to try to convince voters in Iowa, in New Hampshire, in South Carolina as well, that she's really their tribune, that she's not the tribune of the kind of elitist class, I guess you would call it, that, you know, in Harvard, San Francisco, Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of certainly Republicans would like to portray her as. I think Donald Trump would like to portray her as that. And, you know, I don't think he just can't wait to run against somebody from Massachusetts and try to link her to Nancy Pelosi, who's from San Francisco, and then Chuck Schumer, who's from New York City, and say, you know, this is a gang of three here, you know, and try to tether them all together. But I think Elizabeth Warren, at least in some of the midterm elections that she campaigned in, proves that she does have, that she can strike a resonant chord with blue-collar voters if they will listen to her message and kind of take away, I think, some of their preconceived notions of her. And she's actually doing a little bit better now in African-American community. I've heard even, you know, Al Sharpton say that there's really nothing that African-Americans have against her. It's just that Joe Biden has been, you know, he was Barack Obama's vice president, first of all, probably the most popular person in the African-American community. So he strikes a resonant chord and has some bona fides based on that. And just because his views tend to be a little bit more conservative and African-Americans, like members of labor unions, like older voters, tend demographically to be a little bit more conservative than white liberals.
We seem like the presidential field is about the same as before. It feels like there hasn't been too many names that have declared dropped out in recent weeks. So do you think it's going to start to slow down, or do you feel like there's going to be a point where we're going to understand the top five, like instead of the top 10 where we're at right now? Do you feel like is that a dwindling down point? And a bigger question is, do you think there could be someone that enters the game late in the field?
Yeah, there's always speculation, and the speculation, there's speculation out there that Hillary Clinton is going to somehow, that Biden's going to implode and Hillary Clinton is going to supplant her. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't really see where the basis of her support in this race is. If she were to enter the race, first of all, there's a lot of ill feelings toward her because the argument that in the last campaign she made some faux pas, you know, talking about how half of Donald Trump's supporters fall in a basket of deplorables, which Trump was able to use against her. The fact that she never campaigned in the swing state of Wisconsin, which Trump landed up winning, you know, no Democrat had lost that state since George W. Bush. Going back to Ike Dukakis in 1988.
Yeah.
So she made a lot of mistakes, and part of it was a lot of the people who had supported her in 2007, 2008, labor union voters, white blue collar voters, that was her base. And a lot of those people had abandoned her in 2016 because they no longer thought she represented them. And the fact she made so many speeches to Goldman Sachs executives certainly did not help her with that. So don't think that's going to happen. The dream candidate, obviously, would be Michelle Obama, but she doesn't seem to be making any inroads and saying that that's something she's potentially going to want to do. So I think that's a dream candidate for them. I think there are so many candidates that represent so many different constituencies of the Democratic Party. I think this is pretty much what you have right now. And those would be the only star candidates who would probably get on the ballot, you know, in a flash and would automatically be major candidates.
Yeah, they talked about Oprah for a hot minute there.
Yes, I've heard that. The way she's talking, you know, it's interesting. This is why I don't think she would ever do it, because the way she talks basically says, oh, no, it's not. I don't have – she basically says that, to some effect, paraphrasing her, I don't have the fire in my belly to do it. You know, that's what Colin Powell said back in 1995. Mm. Everyone wanted Colin Powell to run. There were polls showing he was going to beat Bill Clinton, and he's probably the only person who could do it. And he was the most popular person in the country, and the Republicans were saying, run, Colin, run. And he went on a book tour, and then finally in the end, he said he's not going to do it. He said, don't have the fire in the belly. When you say you don't have the fire in the belly, it's very hard to then come back and say, well, I got the fire. You know, it's a lot easier when you say, oh, well, that's not something I'm interested in. Right now I'm interested in doing what I'm doing. You know, it's obvious easier when someone's in the Senate or someone's a governor, they say, well, you know, I have a job that I love right now, and right now I'm committed to doing this job, when obviously they're thinking they obviously have a door open in their mind that they're going to do it. But when you say something that's that definitive that would hurt you in a presidential election if you do decide to run, I think that says that she's really not going to run.
Yeah.
Of course, Barack Obama, you know, that being said, after he beat Alan Keyes in 2004 for the Senate race, the next day he said, let me say unequivocally that my only focus is going to be serving the people of Illinois, and I will not run for president. And, of course, he eventually does run for president. But in a Oprah Winfrey's case, I don't think she would actually want that. But, of course, if she were to run, she would obviously be a front runner. Or she would be in those to the top three, I think, pretty handily. But I think what's going to happen, and there is going to be a winnowing down process. You know, there's a debate next week, and I think what's going to happen once you get right around the time, right around Iowa, there's going to be right now you have Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden, and those three are kind of the top tier front runners right now: Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders. But usually there's somebody that comes into the fold that people aren't thinking of. Elections are not decided in August or September or even October of that year. I mean, if they did, you know, you can go back. I mean, in 76, I mean, in 72, you know, Hubert Humphrey or Edmund Muskie would have gotten the nomination. In 76, it probably would have been Scoop Jackson, the front runner that year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 1980, I mean, there were polls showing Ted Kennedy was running against incumbent President Jimmy Carter ahead 2-1. And, of course, eventually the hostage crisis coalesced the support around President Jimmy Carter, and there was a rally around the flag effect, and Carter ended up winning New Hampshire, winning the nomination. In 1992, for example, in 1991, I guess it was, Bill Clinton didn't even announce he was going to be a candidate until October of 1991. So at this time in 1991, you would have had Paul Tsongas and Jerry Brown and Bob Kerry as the front runners.
Mm.
So even in 2004, John Edwards was very low in the polls right around this time period. And what eventually happened that year is Dick Gephardt of Missouri and Howard Dean became mutually assured destructions. They just excoriated each other. And then John Kerry rose up, and voters were looking for another alternative, and they saw John Edwards and his sunny personality, his sunny disposition, and he rose up and became, you know, and became the alternative to John Kerry. Mm-hmm. In 2008, there were polls in the summer of 2007 that showed Hillary Clinton defeating Barack Obama among African Americans, even. Oh. So my guess is there's going to be one candidate. I think it's probably going to either be Mayor Pete Buttigieg of Sullivan, Indiana, or potentially Cory Booker of New Jersey. They're going to get into that top three or potentially the top two. You know, I would even say that there's even a slim possibility that Pete Buttigieg actually wins the Iowa caucuses right now. I think the other candidates could potentially split, and something like that could happen. It could be like when Mike Huckabee won in 2008 because there was such a split between John McCain and Rudy Giuliani and everybody else and Fred Thompson. So that's kind of my supposition right now.
Rich Rubino, our guest on Mondays. His book is called American Politics on the Rocks, which you can find online. We like to look at some of the different events that are happening today and compare them to what's happened in the past. Historically speaking, we're going to talk more about Joe Biden and the situation he's in coming up on Overnight America KMOX. Rich Rubino, American Politics on the Rocks, which you can find on Amazon. I had another question for you about this whole process. So the idea that there is a leading candidate going into the primaries, and there's a nice field of people that are running against him, in this case, Joe Biden, the idea that there could be some sort of investigation called onto that person. Do you see that often where the front runner and of a certain party that may be challenging the sitting president of the United States has a chance of being investigated for wrongdoing?
I don't know specifically. Well, I guess the obvious example would have been probably Hillary Clinton back in 2016. Certainly what was going on with their emails, but voters decided to overlook that. The closest example I can think of, though, and it wasn't something that would be an actual FBI investigation or an investigation, but in 1992, Bill Clinton became the front runner. Part of this was because Mario Cuomo, the former governor of New York, almost decided he was going to run. He was a front runner. He decided not to run. So there were only about six candidates, and then Doug Wilder, the current governor of Virginia, dropped out, and he was after the first elected African American governor. And then a lot of the African American supporters then kind of matriculated from Wilder to Clinton. And then you had a few scandals involving him. One was certainly a Jennifer Flowers coming out and saying that she had had a 12-year affair with Bill Clinton, and the other was the draft issue. There were reports about how Bill Clinton, he had sent a letter to Colonel Holmes about how he had potentially not served in Vietnam and whether he had led protests against the Vietnam War while he was a student at Oxford. So those became issues, and I remember Bob Kerry that year, the senator from Nebraska, who lost a leg in Vietnam, made that an issue against Bill Clinton. But eventually, you know, what happened was Bill Clinton got down to about 6 or 7% in the polls, and it appeared that he probably was going to, you know, drop out at some point. And then all of a sudden, he spends a lot of time, an enormous amount of time in New Hampshire. So in Iowa that year, Tom Harkin was from Iowa. So Tom Harkin, essentially all the candidates conceded Iowa to him because he was going to win by 80%, so no candidate wanted to even spend any time there. He was a hometown boy. So it came to New Hampshire. And Bill Clinton spent an enormous amount of time, and he said, you know what? He said, if you vote for me, he says, I'll be with you until the last dog dies. And the thought was, a lot of the media was actually already saying that Bill Clinton's going to go back to Arkansas, he's going to lose in New Hampshire, and then this is going to be it for him. But he campaigns assiduously in Arkansas and in New Hampshire, rather. And Paul Tsongas is from this neighboring state of Massachusetts, so the expectation is Paul Tsongas is going to win. So he does win, but he doesn't get much credit for it because the thought is, well, you know, you're from the neighboring state, and you're from the neighboring state, obviously you're going to win. Mike Dukakis won, you know, handily, being from Massachusetts, and you're going to win. Ed Muskie in 72 was from Maine, so you're going to win. So the question was, who comes in second place? Mm-hmm. Bill Clinton lost by about 9 points, but he declared himself the comeback kid because of all he had been through. And so he wins New Hampshire. Then he goes down to Georgia, and he gets the support of the Democratic establishment. You know, Del Miller, the governor there, Sam Nunn, the United States senator down there, and Ben Jones, the congressman down there, and who is the former actor. The establishment coalesces for him. Then he wins Georgia. He goes to the South, and he defeats Tsongas, just about everywhere in the South, and eventually becomes the nominee. But that's probably the closest example I can think of where a major candidate, there were really a lot of questions about his about his past, but he still was able to win the nomination, and eventually he went on to pocket the votes of enough electoral votes and won the election.
Wow. You know, one thing you mentioned just a moment ago was there's a debate next week. When did that sneak up on us? There's another debate. How many have qualified for this one? Do you know?
I believe it's about 10. And the interesting thing, in this debate, Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard is qualified.
Oh,
now,
she was
why is
out
it interesting?
Last time.
You say she's at 2% in the polls. Why is this interesting? Well, the first debate, there was a huge thing where Tim Ryan, the congressman from Ohio, was speaking. He's talking about how saying that he was talking about the Taliban. He was talking about how the Taliban was responsible for 9/11. And then Tulsi Gabbard just eviscerates him, says, no, that was Al-Qaeda that did that. Mm-hmm. So that hurt Tim Ryan. In the second debate, Kamala Harris was the victim of the wrath of Tulsi Gabbard because she says, you know, people were in jail when you were attorney general in California, when you were district attorney in California, and you yourself made light of the fact that you had smoked marijuana. And the crowd absolutely erupted in applause for her doing that because she's a minor candidate, but she's willing to really go after people. And I think that a lot of the other candidates don't know which one she's going to go after. You know, Tim Ryan, no one thought she was going to go after Tim Ryan. Kamala Harris, no one thought she was going to go after her. So that's the wild card, is which candidate in this race is she really going to go after? When she goes after, it's scorched earth.
Yeah.
She will go after you for just about anything. You know, she will go probably as far as any candidate will go. And I think of the three major candidates, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden, they're all hoping that she goes after one of the other candidates, I think.
Wow. Could you believe it? 10? Is there a possibility they have to do a twofer where they do two nights?
No, no, no.
None of that anymore.
But I tell you this, though. The other one, Tom Steyer, who you've probably seen in all these advertisements, he's got qualified for the next debate, actually. There's going to be a debate coming up after this one. So he's going to be there, and you know he's really spent a lot of money, an inordinate amount of money, and he's going to be in some of these debates. So he's somebody who hasn't been in any of these debates yet. So we'll see how, if money can buy you the Democratic nomination, or at least buy you a spot as one of the three or four major candidates.
Rich Rubino, if people wanted to check out American Politics on the Rocks, where can they find it?
Yep, just type it on, go to Amazon.com or go to www.polita-geek.com or just find Rich Rubino on Facebook and you can get it either way.
Great. And, of course, your blog, if people wanted to read some of the different things you're doing, what's the website?
www.polita-geek.com.
Polita-geek.com. Rich Rubino, looking forward to having a new time with you starting next week. This will be fun. Thank you for coming on to KMOX.
Will do. Absolutely.
And he joins us on the Quiver River Electric KMOX guest line on Overnight America. I saw this one come through on the CBS Newswire, and I thought, I can believe that. A link between coffee and migraines. I think you get dehydrated. You know what I find too often is that the days that I'm off of work, for example, on a Friday or Saturday, I almost feel like I get that headache because I get that withdrawal because I'm not drinking coffee like I am during the work week. You know, I come into work and the first thing I do is I make a pot of coffee and then I drink that pot of coffee. Well, not the whole pot of coffee, but I do drink coffee in the afternoon. But on the days off, I may have some in the morning, but not really. And I find that it's almost consistent. If I don't drink the coffee, I get the headache. Well, Harvard University says be careful with your coffee and tea. Research says 3 or more cups a day is what I have, over 3 cups a day, associated with development of a headache on par with a migraine. They affect about 1 billion people a year worldwide. 87% of Americans consume caffeine on a daily basis.
Harvard University says be careful of all those cups of Joe and tea. Researchers say 3 or more cups a day is associated with the development of a headache on par with a migraine. Hmm. The study is published in the American Journal of Medicine. Migraines affect about 1 billion people a year all over the world. 87% of Americans consume caffeine on a daily basis. But studies do show that migraines are brought on by a number of possible triggers, including sleep patterns and changes in the weather.
Ooh, the changes in the weather. That's Matt Piper of CBS News. So, just a little heads up for you. You may be drinking coffee right now. You know, I saw this one article on the Daily Mail, and it's an urgent warning for people that use dating apps like Tinder. Anyone listening, have they used the app Tinder? Can you tell me your experience on that? I'm just curious. You know, it's pretty late at night, And I know it's not easy to have a social life if you're working this late at night. So you may rely on dating apps or websites for connection with someone else. If you've ever used Tinder, what's your reaction? I mean, what is it like for you? Have you had a positive or negative reaction to sites like that? 436-7900, let me know, or 800-925-1120. So I found this one article, and they look at different states, or excuse me, in different countries, in this case, Australia. They have a couple of different cases where they say that Tinder, apparently sexual assault is on the rise because of these different apps that are out there right now. Australians who use dating apps of Tinder, the government's now warning them the increase of sexual assaults linked to these online services. An investigation in the past 3 years found more than a dozen cases where men and women were raped, harassed, or stalked after matching online. And that may seem like a pretty low number. That's just the ones that were reported to police. It doesn't seem out of the question that when you use one of these dating apps and the purpose or the main reason for this dating app is not to find a match for you, but to, you know, have someone that you could connect with physically. Well, let's put that very delicately. That seems to be a pretty common thing most people use these apps for. They're just looking for someone that they could hook up with, someone that they could be with physically, and, you know, they don't want necessarily the emotional connection. The emotional connection may be secondary to the other things that they may reach on the app. It doesn't surprise me that when people start using these things, that there are a rise in people that are using it that way. They're using it in a way where maybe they may be connecting with someone that is not going to be wanting to use it that way, but their intention is different from the person they're matching with. And it's probably easy for someone that is out there who perhaps is a predator to use an app that would allow them to connect with people who are perhaps vulnerable or looking for this sort of thing. So I'm surprised the number's not higher. I'm surprised more people aren't reporting this to police. So they give a couple of different examples. So an investigation, here's a few of them that they reported. Dating apps users rely on verbal reports, but they don't know who they're connecting with on there. So if you find that there's a picture and a description, it doesn't actually let you know if the person has a history of violent crimes or sexual crimes or whatever it is. I guess you could do a background check, but how many of you are going to be hopping on a dating app and do like a full-blown paid-for background check to see if there is some sort of history with police, a long track record? So there was one instance where a female doctor met up with a man on Tinder. She was stabbed 11 times and doused in gas after she tried to end their relationship. Dr. Angela J., unaware that the suspect had been arrested 10 times for violence with 5 different women until she tried to actually end the relationship. Wow. Should be some crazy. And now they're saying that these apps, is it their responsibility to let you know when someone has some sort of history, if they've had issues in the past or people have reported on them? If you've actually used one of these apps before, have you had an experience where you got creeped out by what you're seeing? What creeped you out? Or maybe you're someone that stays away from these apps. 436-7900 or 800-925-1120. Before I was married, the dating website started to pop up, and it was a little bit taboo at the time. If you were to meet someone on a dating website and you told them, oh, I met on a dating website, people looked at you a little bit weird. They're like, oh, internet, huh? Well, that's nice. You know, they give you the polite, because, you know, and soon as they're back in the car, they're going to be talking to their friends like, I can't believe they met online. Oh, can you believe those guys? But now it's like common. In fact, now it's so common that if you were to say you met on an app, it's not only that people think twice, it seems to be one of the higher responses if you were to survey people of where they met a certain person. You don't meet out in the wild anymore. You meet on your app. You meet on your phone. You meet on places where you don't have to actually interact with someone face-to-face until, you know, you've already connected and discussed it on your digital device. There was one case, it said, in another case, a victim named Rose was raped by her Tinder date, John, after she wanted to end the relationship. John, which turned out to be not his real name, turned up at Rose's home And after the children left, he forced his way into the home. And, well, that's when the assault occurred. To the mother's horror, John returned months later and started knocking on the door, intoxicated, looking for, you know, to rekindle that, whatever it may be. But they say that she immediately called police, saying the man who allegedly raped was outside her home. The police came and arrested the guy. He had a long history, too. But stalkers, man, they're on the rise, too. You know, there's stalkers everywhere. You're basically welcoming in the ability for, like, if you're on one of those sites and, you know, people are going to be scrolling and looking through these things, you know, you just absolutely guarantee if you're female, there's going to be guys that are stalking you through that website or through that app, mostly because the nature of guys are like that. You know that there's going to be people obsessing over this sort of thing. Now, if they take it to that next level, if they actually decide to bring a physical confrontation or in something in real life, that's a whole different story. But man, you got to be so careful with these apps. I'm just so glad I don't live in that world anymore. I'm glad I don't have to worry about it. I'm so, so fortunate that this was all before my time. You actually had to meet someone in person. Those old days where you caught a glance across the room, those days are over. Now you're catching a look at the app and hoping they're in the same city as you, or at least a couple blocks from you, because you don't want to be too far away from them. All right, so coming up in the next hour, I had a great interview I'm looking forward to share with you. And his name's author Dean Reuter. So he wrote a book called The Hidden Nazi. What a name for a book, too. When we go back and try to read some of these characters that were involved in World War II, in this case, it was someone that was well-trusted by Adolf Hitler, someone that was developing a lot of weapons for the Nazis. You know how close they were to developing a nuke? Honestly, they were like this close. I mean, close. It would have been a game changer for the war. Imagine if the United States got into it with Germany and they had a nuke. Whew. Wonder how that would have changed some of our strategies. But this is the type of guy that is responsible for some atrocities during the Holocaust, and no one knows who he is. In fact, he was one of the highest-ranking people in the Nazi Party. They wrote a book about it called The Hidden Nazi. We're going to talk to Dean Reuter about that in his book coming up in the next hour. And how many American millennials actually have no idea what Auschwitz is? I think that number will shock you, too. It's Overnight America, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.